Haynes v. Zurich.
Morning, Mr. Koenig.
Morning, Your Honors. William Koenig for the defendants. May it please the Court. In the context of addressing the issue of qualified immunity and following the Saussure methodology of addressing whether or not a constitutional right exists first, we're asking this Court to extend the Supreme Court decision in Enquist beyond the employer setting which was involved.
Mr. Koenig, this is going to, you know, seem like a bolt out of the blue, but it's for both of you. Under our precedent, specifically Gosnell versus the City of Troy, there is no appellate jurisdiction to consider an interlocutory appeal like this unless the district court ruled on the qualified immunity issue. And it seems unclear whether the district court was ruling on that issue or not. So I'm going to ask you, and then, you know, later, Mr. Grossman, to address the jurisdictional issue. Perhaps you'd like to submit supplemental briefing on the issue, because I know it just it's you know, hitting you.
Well, we certainly would like to address the supplemental briefs if the Court's raising this issue. We did raise it in the context of qualified immunity. We did ask the Court to rule on the legal issue, the pure legal issue of whether or not a constitutional right was at issue. So I would maintain that the qualified immunity issue was, in fact, addressed, because we asked the Court to address the issue of whether or not a constitutional right existed in the context of qualified immunity.
But the problem is that the order doesn't mention qualified immunity at all.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So had the Court been considering qualified immunity, you would have expected at least the words to be uttered, or a reference to the Saussure against Katz test, since this is obviously pre-Pearson, and Pearson, as everybody agrees, doesn't eliminate it, it just makes it more discretionary. But this looks like an attempted appeal from a motion to dismiss pursuant to Rule 12b-6. That's what the Court says in the second paragraph.
And that's what it was, Your Honor, and qualified immunity can be addressed in the context of a 12b-6 motion.
It's at best, it's highly ambiguous, and since we do have strict rules about interlocutory appeals at the 12b-6 stage, they can't be taken unless there's a 1292b certification, of course, of which there is none here.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, we will await your briefs, but
yeah.
I think there's a very serious jurisdictional issue appeal.
We'll eagerly await them.
Am I turning red?
Yeah.
I thought so. I felt like it.
No. Once we're finished torturing you, we'll torture Mr. Grossman. On the merits.
On the merits.
Would you agree that under Enquist, some discretionary police decision making is off limits from class of one claims? In other words, how are officers to know which kinds of discretionary decisions are subject to these kinds of claims?
Well, I think when we're involved in claims like this, like was involved there, such as was involved in Hilton, which essentially are neighborhood disputes involving petty offenses, as the complaint even characterizes the particular complaints at issue. Those types of things should be off limits to a class of one equal protection claim.
But why is that? If the line that this court has drawn, at least, trying to distinguish those which are undertaken for absolutely no valid reason, with malice, et cetera, you know, just to torture your neighbors, sooner or later, if the police are not responding, or if the police are frivolously arresting over and over again, this man was arrested at least 8 times, 13 criminal charges, the police ignore complaints, at some point, it seems to me, a person does state a claim for a violation of a constitutional right.
Well, I suppose in the extreme.
And if that's true in the extreme, then why don't we need to go forward, develop this record further, find out if the extreme limitations are there? This is a far cry from the dicta in the Supreme Court's decision in Enquist.
Well, The complaint itself characterizes the offenses as petty offenses. The complaint itself lists the types of...
Petty offenses 13 times over can drive a person insane.
Well, I would suggest, just as this court looked to in Moore, looked to whether or not the prosecutor historically had discretion in deciding that a class of one claim would exist, I would submit that, looking to Wren as an example, the Supreme Court has indicated that we're not going to look behind the motive in making an arrest.
But that's one arrest. Now, suppose what the court does not have before it in Wren is suppose you have a record of the same person, let's say, being pulled over every single day. He leaves his house to go to work, and a police officer is waiting for him, pulls him over, holds him up, makes him late to work, maybe he gets fired, you know, whatever. That's the kind of claim Mr. Haynes is trying to raise here, as I understand it. It's not the single instance of prosecutorial discretion, which is obviously protected by law. And Wren also says if the police, in fact, have reasonable suspicion or probable cause to think that an offense has been committed, such as, you know, you didn't put your left blinker on before you turned, even a little offense, if they think it really happened, then they get to pull you over to enforce that law. But that's not the claim Mr. Haynes is raising.
But what I would suggest, Your Honor, at least in your hypothetical, you have what would be characterized as officer-initiated conduct. It's the officers themselves initiating the contact with the plaintiff. Here we have third parties. Here we have what's clearly a neighborhood feud. I mean, the complaint alleges that because of how we handle the complaints, we encourage neighbors to respond. It's not to say that there wasn't probable cause for any of the actions at issue. And I submit that the Fourth Amendment and the existence of the Fourth Amendment provides enough assurance that the actions of the officers are not going to be arbitrary and capricious. There's no clear standard.
On the merits, one might get there, but I think that there is officer initiative that's being charged here. The neighbors complain, somebody complains, that only Haynes gets arrested, and every time the charges are dropped.
That's correct. That's the complaint. But again, Your Honor, I'm focusing on...
But if we buy into your sort of extension of Inquist and we follow your reasoning to its logical conclusion, doesn't every government activity that involves considerable discretion become immune from class of one suits because nearly every government activity is performed by government employees?
And I think that's where Inquist draws the line. It says at least in OLEC there was a clear standard against which we could judge departures from that standard. You know, there was, you required a 15-foot easement for everybody else, but in the case of the plaintiff, you required a 33-foot easement. I mean, the court was clear that said what seems to us to have been important in OLEC was a clear standard against which departures could be judged. And all I'm suggesting is there's no equal protection claim. There may be other causes of action that a plaintiff may have. There may be Fourth Amendment violations that can be raised. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that the equal protection claim, class of one, which I would suggest is nothing more than a substantive due process claim, shouldn't exist.
Why is it substantive process if you're saying here is Mr. Haynes, here's the rest of the world, there's one rule that applies to Mr. Haynes when the police act vis-a-vis him, i.e. there's no probable cause requirement. There's another rule that applies to the rest of the population. There is a probable cause requirement. Why isn't that a denial of equal protection?
Because the complaint doesn't say there's no probable cause. He is not maintaining in this case, and there's no allegations that probable cause was lacking to arrest him. That's my point. This is purely, purely a class of one. He's not saying you guessed wrong.
I don't know about that, actually.
This is not a Fourth Amendment claim, and there's no allegations of lack or absence of probable cause.
It's unequal enforcement.
That's correct.
Deliberate and malicious unequal enforcement.
Your Honor, clearly that's what it alleges. But he doesn't allege that the neighbors weren't credible. He doesn't allege a conspiracy between us and the neighbors. He simply says, you arrested me on the complaints of my neighbors. When I complain about my neighbors, you didn't arrest them. That's what he says.
Well, but the fact that none of these are sustained.
Well, Your Honor.
Doesn't that give you some pause?
Your Honor, when you're looking at neighbors and feuding neighbors, don't you think mm-hmm. that neighbors pretty much get intimidated by, may very well have been intimidated by Mr. Haynes? And so the
apparently
fact,
not. They
no, they don't stop.
You know, cases are dismissed for want of prosecution. The police officers don't have control over whether or not a judge dismisses a case or whether or not a prosecutor dismisses a case. Again, I emphasize that this is a purely class of one claim. There is no allegations of lack of probable cause, and I don't think Mr. Grossman is going to say that the complaint alleges lack of probable cause.
Well, I can't wait to hear, so.
Thank you, Your Honor. I see my time has run out.
Get him up here, yeah. That red light went on a while ago. Okay. Hi, Mr. Grossman.
Hello. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is...
Talk about jurisdiction.
Yes. My name is Richard Grossman. Represent the plaintiff. May it please the court. You know, I'm not sure just how much I want to defend the jurisdiction, but if pressed, I would say that, and this could be one of those cases where the counsel that are participating are so deeply involved that they miss this huge Himalayan issue that's that everybody else sees.
Are you calling the police on each other? Is that it?
No, I every respect for Mr. Koenig. He's a wonderful lawyer. I think if I assume what I'm going to see, if you're going to allow supplemental briefs, is you're going to see the pleadings, the actual motion that they filed, and it seems to me beyond the argument that if you look at it, they're talking about qualified immunity. You're right. This is a bolt from the blue. I never realized until just now when I reread the opinion that Judge Norgal never mentioned the words qualified immunity. But I'm at a loss to explain why he didn't. But if you read the pleadings and the response thereto, that is the motion that produced this opinion, you'll see that we're talking about qualified immunity. But if you find that it isn't, well, that's okay with me too.
Okay.
In any event, if the issue before you is, did the Supreme Court in Enquist overrule Hilton? I don't believe it did. And I think they specifically disavow an intention to do that. They limit the opinion and are at pains to do so to the employment context, specifically the governmental employment context.
You're right with the exception of the fact that there are those couple of paragraphs, or maybe it's one paragraph, but there's the section of the opinion where the court is explaining its thinking, and it notes this more generic difference between a case like OLEC, and they actually give a law enforcement example, which opens the door to Mr. Koenig's argument that... Well, I guess the one thing one could take from Enquist is the court wants to treat class of one claims with kid gloves because we really don't want to be in the business of adjudicating every single little neighborhood dispute. You know, people joke and say, oh, you're making a federal case of it, and we don't want to do that. And the court is trying to somehow keep this genie in the bottle and at the same time stand by its OLEC ruling.
I agree with you, and certainly the main concern underlying Enquist is they don't want to turn every promotion or pay cut or something into a constitutional case. And similarly, you wouldn't want to turn every single arrest or non-arrest that an officer makes into a constitutional case. But I think, Your Honors, that you were hitting on in the right direction when you said there comes a point when this is no longer just one instance of somebody using some undoubtedly broad discretion in either to arrest somebody or not to arrest somebody. But when a repeated course of conduct is pursued where it evinces an intent to persecute someone, I think you've reached it. And
so let me get clear the line. I mean, one line may be clear standards like 15-foot easements or
that's
not
easy.
Yeah. Another line that you're proposing that would allow the kind of inference that this court has looked for of persecution, if you will, is the repeated case where you actually can't draw the inference from the first arrest or the second arrest, but there comes a time, very much like in harassment cases or other cases, where the pattern has become established. That would be perhaps consistent with this court's law and not the same thing as the hypothetical in Enquist. But where do we get that from,
well,
other than just making it up?
I was a lawyer in Hilton, and when Judge Posner said, well, you're out of court because you can't supply us the illegitimate animus for whatever reason you didn't decide to do discovery, and here we have. In other words, this is not just a situation where we're alleging that some just a collection of incidents, coincidences, and you know, arbitrary meetings or fleeting encounters. We're saying that we have a, and we attach to our complaint a transcript of the 911 call in which the neighbor says, I want to report Haynes, and the policeman says, oh yeah, I know this guy. We hate this guy. And then,
so your position, from a pleading point of view, I guess, is under Twombly and Iqbal, et cetera, the new world of pleading,
right,
that this transcript is sufficiently detailed.
Well, it supplies the in that. It's not just a conclusion. It's saying, I'm saying that they are doing this in that they have an illegitimate animus because I can prove it because they say so. And additionally, I've supplied, I believe, well, maybe just attached to the complaint. I think it was in my brief, but where they have the rap sheet, so to speak. Man's never been convicted of anything in his life, and he's branded a career criminal. I mean, it says right on the sheet, it says, reasons to be cautious, career criminal. Now, it seems to me that at some point, when you add up that he's been arrested 8 times, that they never ever, he calls the police about his neighbor, and they arrest him. Right. So at some point, it becomes clear that what's going on here is they don't like him. They've taken sides. They've said to themselves, you know what? We're going to arrest the guy every time we see him to teach him a lesson. And by the way, Stahor is the record, but they've arrested him again. So it gets to the point where I think the conclusion is unavoidable, and I would suggest that it's been reached in this case. Now,
Or to be more accurate about what we're doing here, I mean, I guess what you have to be arguing, if we assume that there was a ruling on qualified immunity despite the district court's failure to mention that, you would have to say that you have pleaded in your complaint enough to be able to go forward, enough to show that a claim has been stated. Now, the district court, one of the flaws of the district court not talking about qualified immunity is if the district court had found a claim stated, there still would have been the inquiry about whether it was a clearly established right, et cetera. There would have been further discussion in the district court.
I think he does. I think Judge Norville does refer to the fact that Hilton, in the last paragraph of the decision, he talks about the fact that Hilton does set forth the standard, mm-hmm, and that this is really just a more or less a replay of the Hilton case. And I would note also that Judge Posner was on the panel, which, in Hilton, he was on the panel in Moore, which then refers to Enquist, and it also refers to Hilton. I don't think that Judge Posner would have included a reference to Hilton if he thought that it no longer had vitality.
I want to ask you sort of a metaphysical question, and it's this. How is an officer who is making decisions based on personal animus exercising discretion? It would seem to be the opposite of discretion, or at least the opposite of anything resembling legitimate use of discretion.
Well, that's the essence of the complaint, that it is not a legitimate use of discretion. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I would agree with you that it is not a legitimate use of the officer's authority. I mean, we vest the policemen with the authority to arrest people and maintain the peace and so forth, and really it seems like what they're doing here is being judge and jury, and they decided they don't like my client, and they're going to torture him.
Yeah, but look at how good it is for your business.
Right, I've had 2 cases so far. I'd ask the court either to find that there's no jurisdiction, or affirm the court's opinion below. Okay, thank you.
Did his time expire?
It did. I'm going to give you a minute. I think your time expired.
I think that's, Your Honor. It has, but I would just make one comment. You didn't hear any mention of a contention that probable cause was lacking. I suggest that the line that we draw is where police officers arresting somebody willy-nilly without probable cause, repeatedly, or some legitimate animus, may be where the line is drawn. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both of you. Now, hold on. An order will come out regarding how much time we want for supplemental briefing. If the three of us agree that we want supplemental briefing. Okay? Okay.